Hello there, you're watching Left, Right and Centre on NDTV. I'm Maha Siddiqui. India is sitting on a health disaster, or so it appears from a Lancet report which says that over 11% Indians are diabetic, while 35% of the people suffer from hypertension. The study conducted by the Madras Diabetes Research Foundation in collaboration with the Indian Council of Medical Research and other institutes also found that the prevalence of generalized obesity and abdominal obesity in India stood at 28.6% and 39.5%. Is India facing a health crisis? And if yes, what can we do about it? That's our first discussion this evening. Our second discussion tonight, Donald Trump faces his second indictment, but the former president brazens it out, calls himself the target of a witch hunt. How can this impact his presidential bid for 2024? That's the big question at the moment. But first up, an alarming Lancet report is confirming what doctors in India largely have been warning people about. A survey shows that 35.5% of Indians suffer from hypertension. 15.3% of people have pre-diabetes, while an alarming 81.2% have dyslipidemia, the imbalance of lipids such as cholesterol. The report says that the prevalence of diabetes and other metabolic NCDs in India is considerably higher than previously estimated. While the diabetes epidemic is stabilizing in the more developed states of the country, it is now increasing in the other states, and that clearly is a cause of concern.
India is sitting on a diabetes time bomb. According to a decade-long research by Indian Council of Medical Research for Lancet, three peninsular states, Goa, Kerala and Puducherry, record the highest diabetes cases. But that's not all. 101 million people in India have diabetes. That's around 11.4% of the population, 31% higher than WHO's 2019 estimate. In fact, 15.3% or 136 million Indians have pre-diabetes, while 39.5% Indians are obese. And at least 35% Indians have hypertension. Over 1 lakh Indians were surveyed from October 2008 to 2020 by ICMR, and the data was extrapolated based on population. Now, which kind of diabetes is prevalent? Type 2 diabetes is the most common form which is prevalent, where people have high blood sugars but are unable to generate enough insulin, a hormone according to the ICMR research. What should you be doing? What's your lifestyle, including work life and personal life balance, and what you eat? Test regularly if your family has a diabetes history. Better to be on the side of caution. Sneha Koshi for NDTV.
Let's discuss this very important health crisis that Indians are facing. Let me bring in our guests now, Dr. V. Mohan, Chairman, Dr. Mohan's Diabetes Specialities Center, a senior author of the study and Chairman of the Madras Diabetes Research Foundation as well. Dr. Ambrish Mittal, Chairman and Head Endocrinology and Diabetes, Max Hospital. Dr. Sunila Garg, Chairperson, National Institute of Health and Family Welfare, Ministry of Health and Family Welfare, Government of India. And a member of Lancet Commission, advisor to ICMR as well. Dr. Ashish Chaudhary, Managing Director, Akash Healthcare. Dr. Kanika Malhotra, Health and Fitness Coach, Diabetes Educator. Dr. V. Mohan, I want to come first to you, sir. We've seen examples recently of very young people suffering heart attacks, many of them at gyms. And now, it shows that the modern country, the young India, is also trying to keep itself fit. Despite that, something is going very grossly wrong. How is India facing this crisis despite more awareness about health?
I would slightly disagree with you about the awareness and the fitness and so on. What you're referring to is the creme de la creme of society, the top 1 or 2%. If you take the average Indian, they are struggling actually to make both ends meet, and very few of them do exercise. When we see 1,000 people walking on the road, we think that a lot of people are doing exercise. You realize, don't realize that millions of people are not doing the exercise. So this epidemic of diabetes and the sharp rise is driven by two or three things. One is physical inactivity. There's no doubt at all that people who used to walk are now going by two-wheelers or cars, and the physical activity has gone down. Stress levels have increased because a lot of people are working extra hours. Now, you mentioned some sudden deaths which occurred, including that of a doctor. I understand that particular doctor had done 16,000 surgeries in 10 years. That works out to 1,600 surgeries a year. There's like four or five cardiac surgeries in a day. Now, that's quite a lot of work, a lot of pressure. And that's not the only profession that people have pressure in. The other thing is excess junk foods, excess calories, sugar, carbohydrate particularly being taken in excess. All this has driven the obesity epidemic, and that has translated into diabetes and pre-diabetes. But while we talk about the alarming increase, I would also like to mention that here is a golden opportunity for us to actually prevent diabetes. You mentioned quite rightly that 136 million people have pre-diabetes. This is a stage before diabetes. Now, we have a golden opportunity here to discuss with these 136 million people and tell them that even a slight weight reduction, 4 or 5 kg, you don't have to lose 20, 30 kilos, 4 or 5 kgs in weight reduction, you sleep on time, you cut your carbohydrate, include more vegetables and fruit and some healthy proteins in your diet, and walk every day. This is all that is needed to prevent pre-diabetes from going to diabetes. And in fact, you can even reverse the pre-diabetes and become normal. So while this is a wake-up call, I wouldn't say it's a health crisis or alarming or something. This is what the country, one of the prices we pay for affluence is that we put on weight and we change our lifestyle. So I think it's all back to lifestyle, back to the basics. We should sleep on time, get enough sleep and so on, and do what our grandfathers did. And if we do that, I think we can halt this diabetes epidemic. So I will take this more as a wake-up call and something which is a call to action.
Dr. V. Mohan, I'll come back to you, sir, because there are certain questions that I want to take forward from what you've said. But before that, I want to go across to Dr. Amrish Mittal, because from the point Dr. Mohan made, I'm just looking at world over. I mean, these kind of lifestyle changes are being seen world over, not just in India. People are staying up late, not sleeping on time, working a lot more, stress levels are high. But why are we seeing these dramatic health concerns emerging more in a country like India?
I think it reflects the growth, the growing economy and change, which is why you're seeing, you know, when my professor and Mohan, everyone knows Professor Ahuja, when he did his studies in the 70s, the prevalence was 2%, 3%. Those are the figures, even less than that in rural areas we're talking about. So when there is economic growth, there is a natural change in lifestyle. And with urbanization, less physical activity, easy access to food, energy-dense food, ability to order food, and this is not always related to affluence now, because actually everyone is, you know, ordering food and eating food regardless of where they are in the social ladder. So there is an increase. Clearly, the difference you are seeing is largely a result of our economic growth, unfortunate result of our economic growth. Also, that comes out very clearly in the differences between states that the study has shown. So those areas which are already economically developed, there is some degree of stabilization happening between diabetes, pre-diabetes, and the numbers are sort of leveling out a little bit, very high, but nevertheless leveling out. Whereas in states which are less developed, the difference is a lot. The overall prevalence seems less. In my home state of UP, it's 8.1%, but then pre-diabetes is so high. So the issue is that the population as a whole is prone to develop diabetes. We don't know if there's any genetic, solid genetic basis for this, or just a change in our lifestyle and environment. But the key point is that all those pre-diabetics in a state like UP deserve to be given facilities and education to prevent them from becoming diabetic and maybe reverse their pre-diabetes to diabetes. So it's definitely a function of economic growth. It's not limited to India. You can see it in Latin America. Countries where economies have changed are booming now. There has been a marked increase in the prevalence of diabetes.
So, Dr. Sunila Garg, then if such is the case that There are high pre-diabetes cases, and then we can, in fact, reverse those cases as well, as Dr. Amrish Mittal is pointing out. But the fact is that many people perhaps would not even be aware that they are in a situation of this nature. What does this mean? Do we need to compulsorily put everyone through health screenings?
Thank you, Maa Siddiqui, for having me on the show, number one. Also say that at this point of time, you know, under Ayushman Bharat, we have got 150,000 health and wellness centers. And amongst 12 task forces, one of the task forces is aiming at non-communicable diseases. That means it is aiming at diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular diseases, stroke, and, you know, cancers and all. Amongst that, you know, we find that, you know, diabetes and hypertension, they take a major toll. And as has been pointed out by Dr. Mohan, this is, you know, basically the over a period of time, our lifestyles have changed. We have become more sedentary. Stress and strain is more high. And I will say that our recent studies have proved, you know, that it is, you know, not only an urban scenario, it is also a rural scenario as well. So that is where, though this study has proved that more it is seen in, you know, urban areas, but I will say that in rural areas also, comparatively, we are seeing larger number of cases as well. So what is important is that we are now also focusing on front of package labeling, because we are having, you know, high number of individuals who are consuming, you know, foods which are rich in, you know, salt, sugar, fats, and calories, etc. So that is where it is very, very important to change our lifestyles. And, you know, we are focusing now from health to wellness. That is very important. And we have to reach, as our Prime Minister says, that we have to reach last mile, or now he says first mile. So it becomes very important that right from frontline workers to our paramedical workers, to community health officers, to our, you know, physicians, whether we talk of government sector, private sector, we have to create awareness and awareness at a massive level. So that is one thing which is very important. Okay. And we have to focus not only on this thing, you know, whether we focus on lifestyle, but diabetes is also majorly related to our foods also. That is one thing which is very important. And this year is year of millets also. So we have to focus on that part. So together we have to have a very holistic approach, and we have to move from health to wellness.
All right.
That is important.
So let's start with a little bit of awareness on this show itself. Dr. Ashish, are there any symptoms that one can look at and then approach the doctor? Any red flags that one should be watching out for on a daily basis?
So as a surgeon, I'm not the right person to tell you the symptom, but on a daily basis, I see a lot of patients who come for surgical evaluation. And I'm so surprised that the young patients, as young as 21 year, 22 year, coming for fracture surgery or a joint problem. And when we investigate, we find the HbA1c levels more than 10 or 12. And their fasting sugar levels are skyrocketing more than 300. So that comes as a surprise for us as well as for the patient, because they never thought they could be suffering from so much of high sugar levels. If this study per se also indicates, it's only a stamping what we have been seeing for last many years, especially during the COVID times, all those three peaks, we have seen people have been, you know, totally sedentary, and before that as well. And thereafter, I mean, we are seeing a fraction of people on the roads doing for fitness. Yes, awareness has increased, but I still feel the early signs of, you know, increased urination, you know, increase in appetite, sudden weight loss initially, and then, you know, wound not healing in the body anywhere, and then some vision issues. So there are some subtle signs, the early signs, which I think every clinician, right from the MBBS level to the top-notch endocrinologist, should be able to educate the public, community. And I think the health screening, what you just talked about, that's a very effective tool. We, in our own small capacity, every week we have a, you know, health camp sort of evaluation of the surrounding community. And every time we screen 100 patients, we find 3 or 4 new diabetics. And that's a very alarming number in a small setting. Imagine, and we extrapolate to whole of India, I think there are so many pre-diabetic or undiagnosed diabetic patients who could be diagnosed at much earlier speed, and they should be prevented from going to from bad to worse, and also suffering from various complications related to the deadly disease.
Absolutely. But Dr. Kanika, a lot of times, you know, people will tell you that the balance between exercise and food is 80% to 20%, means 20% exercise influences your body and 80% of food. Are we eating the wrong kind of food?
So very rightly put in by Dr. Mohan and Dr. Garg, changing lifestyles and, you know, migration to cities, erratic working hours, sitting is the new smoking, and we have a lot of stress, easy availability of the junk food, as Dr. Mohan rightly put in. So these all are the imbalances that have created that imbalance between your food and exercise. Of course, there is a direct connection between the two, but we need to look at both the aspects, whether it is eating right or staying active. Most importantly, it's the habits that we need to work. We need to foodicate ourselves, especially the ladies of the house. So there is a right the kind of balance that we need to maintain between the physical activity and eating right. Not just healthy, we need to eat right as well.
What does eating right mean exactly?
So eating right means not only focusing on your carbs, proteins, fats, but also working on your habits and choosing the right kind of food which suits your lifestyle. Like Dr. Garg rightly put it, it's the year of millets. Choosing the right kind of whole grains, choosing up your healthy fats, giving up on your sugary items. As we always say, tel kam, chini kam, namak kam. Even if you're taking all these stuff, just try and reduce it to half. So try, go beyond your macronutrients, which is your fats, carbohydrates, and your fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. Look at your micronutrient levels as well. Look at the most underrated nutrient called water. So please include all these things and go beyond these things so that your diabetes or pre-diabetes can be reversed very easily.
Dr. Mohan, you know, taking a cue from what Dr. Kanika is saying, a lot of times, you know, there are very confusing and conflicting information that comes about, and you know, people are left perplexed. For instance, for a long time, we were made to believe that cholesterol is as a result of eating too much fatty food or too oily food. Now, a lot of people completely give up on oil, I mean, as much as they can. Then you have a research saying if you don't take enough, you know, if there's not enough fat or oil in your body, then there'll be lack of vitamin D. How does an ordinary person strike the balance, sir? It's very difficult. Can you help us understand how one should be able to maintain a proper healthy lifestyle?
Let me put it very simply for the layperson. When you talk about carbohydrate, protein, fat, micronutrients, a common man or common lady is going to get totally confused.
Yes.
Let's make it very simple. You have a thali, a plate. Okay. What do we do in the south? We'll put rice, and then we'll put rice and sambar. Then it'll be rice and rasam. Then it'll be rice and curd. And then there'll be rice and something else. We are keeping on eating carbohydrate. Okay. Where is the protein? There's no protein at all, especially for vegetarians. If you want to have a balanced diet, half of that thali or that plate should be filled with vegetables, and that too non-starchy vegetables. That will give you all the things which, you know, was talked about, vitamin D or vitamin B12, nutrients, B complex, everything you need will be given there. Quarter of your plate should be reserved for protein. Now, for a non-vegetarian, there is lean meat or fish or even egg. Whereas for vegetarians, a problem comes. So you'll have to look for your protein. Bengal gram, green gram, black gram, mushroom, a glass of milk maybe. So these are the only things which will give you protein. So you must add protein in your meal. Once you've added protein, satiety will come and your carbs will automatically come down. From the same INDIAB study, we published a paper just about 3-4 months ago, where on a population level for the whole of India, we worked out, if about 10 to 15% you reduce the carbohydrate in India and increase the protein content by about 10%, you can actually stop this epidemic of diabetes from growing, and you can even reverse it. So just remember the thali concept. Remember to have vegetables every day, green leafy vegetables, not the starchy vegetables. Have enough protein, cut down on your carbohydrate. This makes it a very simple formula. And anybody can understand. So if it's the north or the west of India, have chapati there in that quarter of that plate. If you're in the east or the south of India, have your rice. But then that's the amount of rice that you can put in the quarter of your plate is obviously much less than 3 times if you put it in the whole of your plate. So this simple concept, I think, is enough to capture the right eating. Don't forget that along with that, also have enough physical activity. As was mentioned, sitting is the new smoking, and therefore get up every hour and walk for a couple of minutes. See that you get at least 6,000 to 7,000 steps, if not 10,000 steps a day. And this can be a simple formula. Again, there is when you get a phone on your mobile phone, you know, you don't have to sit and take that call. Walk about in the room. You'll get 500 steps, 1,000 steps straight away with every call. So simple things like, of course, don't forget sleep. Sleep is very important. Sleeping on time, sleeping at least 6 to 8 hours a day. So what our ancestors did is something which we should go back to. The modern lifestyle of staying up to 2 a.m. and watching movies and having screen addiction and all that is definitely one of the causes of obesity or whole circadian rhythm gets upset. So if you go back to the basics and just follow this, I think these numbers that we are talking about today, although they seem very alarmist, there is something which can be done to reverse it at this stage.
Absolutely. They really do seem very alarming. And while you've really explained how one should eat and what one's thali should look like, I also have some, points that confuse people, Dr. Ambrish Mittal, as far as exercise is concerned. We've seen, as I pointed out initially, deaths occurring in gyms. People are exercising and they've fallen on the treadmill itself. Now, what does it show us? Is too much of exercise also bad for the body?
I think those are very rare cases, you know. Too much exercise, and not too many Indians are doing too much exercise. I think basically you have to listen to your body. If you're in that age group or if you have a cardiac condition, you have to ask your doctor how to start. Basically, graded exercise, if you're not exercising at all, start slowly and then gradually increase. You can start by simple walking. You see, these are all a lot of personal choices. If someone likes group activity, he may want to do aerobics. Someone prefers to do it alone at home, he may want to do yoga. So you have to mix it up. You have to have a mixture of aerobic exercise plus some resistance training, some muscle building exercise. And that aerobic exercise can be of many kinds. And of course, if you add yoga for stretches, that makes it very complete. So I would say for all of us, about 40, 45 minutes of physical activity, structured physical activity every day, plus taking the steps all the time, walking to the parking lot instead of having the car come over there, and all those things, as Mohan suggested, you know, just walking with your phone when you take a call. Indians spend half their day on calls only. So, you know, if they're walking all the time, they will actually have a lot of steps. So these kind of activity, there's no need to go crazy. The cases you have heard of, most of the time are also taking agents for bodybuilding. I have seen many such cases, youngsters who walk like that. You know, everyone wants to be a Salman Khan or Sanjay Dutt without realizing what it takes. And the thing is that they take lots of steroids, androgens, so many other things. And all that could potentially have a damaging effect on the heart in the long run. And many of these people, when they're exercising and overambitious in their exercise, they land up with these problems. So I think that is a very serious issue in a particular segment of the population. This craze about bodybuilding and craze about taking stuff which is not safe against advice of doctors, based on the gym advice, and then landing up with serious consequences. And we do see that in metropolitan cities. We do see that.
I'll once again, from exercise, go back to food. Dr. Sunila Garg, while access to food has certainly improved in the country, and we do see people getting 2 square meals a day, but a large part of that meal, as Dr. Mohan was pointing out, is carbohydrates. And many people, especially those who cannot afford proteins, believe that if their stomach is full, they are good to go. Now, how do you change the entire system over here as well? Because we have enough wheat and enough rice. It's always produced in more quantities. The production of millets has gone down so drastically. The access or millets can't be kept for a long time. Their shelf life is also low. How does the entire system have to change to bring in that change in lifestyle that we are, facing at the moment, resulting in this health crisis?
I think, first of all, one has to understand that the plate has to be full of colors. That is important. So that will take care of your, when we talk of food pyramid, at the base of, you know, has got, you know, proteins and carbohydrates, and which Dr. Mohan pointed out that we must be reducing carbohydrate and increase, you know, fruit, proteins. But on top of it will come 2 to 3 servings of vegetables, and on top of it will come fruit, and then, you know, fat will form a little part of it. So basically we have to see that, you know, when we say that our food, our plate has to be full of colors, that means, and it has got to be locally available food, and, you know, also which are culturally acceptable. When we are talking of India, we are talking of not only rural urban population, we have a huge, you know, 10% of our population is also tribal population, which is still unexplored. So we need to look at, you know, see that what are the locally available foods and which are acceptable. But more important is we need to add on to it the servings of fruits, vegetables and all that. One of the recent survey, which was the largest survey on non-communicable diseases, was also looking at that people hardly eat fruits and vegetables and all, though they will spend more on junk foods and all that. And let me tell you, junk food percolation has gone even to the rural areas as well. So that is where our awareness creation becomes very, very important. And as I've been pointing out also, that, you know, different academies and associations, you know, when we talk of professional associations, have started focusing on front of package labeling, so that individual knows when he's eating a packet of chips and all that, how much calories is he taking, how much salt is going inside and all that. So it's not only this, we are talking of ultra processed foods, you know, so we have to focus on that part also, and which is responsible for high chunk of obesity. As this study pointed out that, you know, not only, you know, it's obesity, which is very high, and it's also, you know, the waist circumference, which is high. So we have to look at whenever there is central obesity, which is very high, you know, higher chances of cardiovascular diseases also go up. So that's where, you know, the major, our focus has got to be on diet, along with, you know, the exercises part. But we need to focus on Ayush part. And Ayush means we are talking of, you know, yoga, we are talking of meditation and all these, which have already, you know, been a part of our health and wellness centers. And now, you know, regularly we are starting these activities as part of this. So as I again telling you that we have to move from health to wellness also.
Yes, and we are running out of time, so I'll quickly put the questions to Dr. Ashish and Dr. Kanika. Dr. Ashish, as I was saying, that the entire system, the way in which we conduct our lives now has changed so drastically that it requires, you know, a complete overhaul, which one person alone can't do. For instance, if work hours are too long for people, if stress is too high, if work is too demanding, then an individual person cannot change it. The system requires the change is required in the system, in the manner in which we work. Do you think as a developing country, we can afford that at the moment?
Absolutely. See, you know, change has to start from an individual. If I work 10 hours a day or 12 hours a day, I'm not having meals on time, not having enough time for walking or any physical activity. You know, that is the first thing I have to change. It's for myself. I mean, yes, people are in the rat race for earning a lot of money and getting settled, more designations, but always at the cost of health. If I look at, you know, around myself, even my clinicians, doctors are also suffering big time from non-communicable diseases. And the reasons remains the same. They are preoccupied with their clinical work. They are not able to focus on their health. So somewhere or the other, I mean, yes, government always comes as a, you know, a supporting platform for each and every citizen. But, you know, government can't do it unless there's a motivation from the community. We have got our RWS, we have got our, you know, hospital community outreach programs. We have got so many societies which can work in coordination with the local people, local leaders, who can at least motivate people to go out and check themselves at least once in 6 months or once in a year, so that we are able to catch hold of all these non-communicable diseases much earlier phase and prevent the disability, a long-term disability. So it has to start from an individual and go up till the highest level in the country, because ultimately if this much of population is suffering and they are going to have so many thousands and thousands of man-hour losses, which is ultimately going to affect the economy. So we are actually promoting and helping not only the physical health, it is actually a health, overall health of the country. The economic health also lies in improving, identifying these NCDs much earlier on and preventing early deaths, which we are seeing rampantly after COVID. So that also is an alarming state. And whatever study has concluded, it is a stamp on the thing that we have to change our lifestyle. We have to go back to the old habits. We have to start walking. We have to stop utilizing automobile for every small little activity. And sum up, all these efforts will focus and come down heavily on these diseases, and we'll be able to show some better pictures, better numbers in the next few years.
Dr. Ashish, you know, I would perhaps beg to differ over here, because I believe that since every individual, and in a developing economy, in a developing country, everybody wants to perform well. And therefore, perhaps the overhaul needs to be from the system itself, maybe setting of some sane hours of working. Maybe the labor laws need to be enforced properly across board, across all industry, because as you said, very rightly, that this can have an economic cost on the country, considering that we are sitting on a diabetes, on a, you know, heart diseases time bomb. Dr. Kanika, final point that I want to understand from you. Do patients come to you and express this desire of wanting to lead healthy lifestyles, but being unable to do it because they are caught in the rat race?
Yes, all the time, daily. In fact, people who are in the age group of especially 30 to 50, they are very concerned that, you know, I have a family history of diabetes, my parents are diabetes, you know, please help me lose weight. I don't want to prick myself daily. I don't want to take those injections. That fear is something that drives them, because they want to stay healthy. And of course, yes, there are taxing hours that they need to work. There is increased screen time. So screen time is actually me time for them. And gluing up to the screens, waking up late at night, waking up late in the morning is something that they are not able to work on. So I would say, beyond individual behavior, be it families, the lady of the house, working on the menus of the canteen in schools, at workplaces, you know, conducting nutrition education sessions in the dietetics community, we always say, be food-educated, have that food education, learn how to read the labels, learn about the food, what it means. And I think all these things need to come together to make healthier choices, easy choices, so that they are able to prevent diabetes. And if the person is pre-diabetic, you are able to reverse it.
Absolutely. Many thanks to all our panelists for joining us here on the show on this very critical discussion. With that, we're taking a very quick break. Up next, look who's in trouble again. Donald Trump faces his second indictment. What does it mean for his race to the president's post in 2024? We'll be coming back with that discussion. He has now been indicted on charges of mishandling classified documents and violation of the Espionage Act. But despite the setback, Donald Trump remains brazen. He calls himself innocent and the target of a witch hunt.
Very sadly, we're a nation in decline, and yet they go after a popular president, a president that got more votes than any sitting president in the history of our country, by far. And did much better the second time in the election than the first. And they go after him on a boxer's hoax. I'm an innocent man. I'm an innocent person. They had the Mueller hoax, the Mueller report, and that came out. No collusion after 2.5 years. That was set up by Hillary Clinton and Democrats. But this is what they do. This is what they do so well. If they would devote their energies to honesty and integrity, will be a lot better for our country.
So what does this mean for Donald Trump going forward in the race for 2024? Joining me now on the show, Meera Shankar, former Indian ambassador to the United States of America, Dr. Sampath Shivangi, former advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, U.S., member of the Donald Trump for President, Inc., or supports Donald Trump. On the other hand, we also have Ajay Jain Bhutoria, a Biden supporter, Vice Chair, Presidential Inauguration Committee. But before I go across to my guest, let me bring in Steve Herman, Chief National Correspondent of Voice of America. Steve, many thanks for joining us here on the show. My first question to you is with regards to information that is just coming in that Donald Trump's lawyer on the classified documents case has quit What can you share with us as far as the details about who's going to represent him now?
Yes, it's actually two lawyers, James Trusty and John Rowley, who had been a key part of Trump's legal team representing him with the discussions that had been going on with the Department of Justice, have left. It's unclear exactly what led to this, but Donald Trump has announced on his social media platform that they have been replaced by another lawyer who will be representing him from now on and when he appears initially in federal court in Miami next Tuesday.
Steve, none of this will prevent Donald Trump from bidding for the president's post in 2024. Does it impact that?
No, he is not convicted of anything at this point. He is free and clear to run for president. Now, if he were to be convicted of a felony and would become president or win a general election, it could be very different circumstances. There are already two challengers in the Republican Party field in the primary election who are suggesting that it's time for Trump to step aside now that he is facing criminal charges in Florida.
But do some Republicans believe that the fact that he is calling this a witch hunt and that the entire other side, his rivals, are after him, will also help him gain some sympathy within his own supporters?
Well, I think what we're expecting, and you talk to political analysts about this, and I think members of your panel will probably agree as well, that there's this core base of Trump supporters, perhaps about one third of the Republican Party voters, that are going to stick with him no matter what. That's not going to make a difference. But overall, in this country, 6 of 10 potential voters in the general election say that Donald Trump should not be president again. Is it possible for him to win for a third consecutive time the Republican Party nomination, of which he is the front runner right now? Absolutely. Especially with so many other candidates splitting up what would be the anti-Trump vote, or those previous Trump supporters who might have qualms about it now. But the odds are against him on winning a general election, especially if he's facing a federal criminal trial.
Steve Herman, many thanks for joining us here on NDTV. Let me now go across to our guest. Let me also introduce Jonah Blank, former policy advisor to Joe Biden, foreign policy expert, National University of Singapore. I want to first go across to Dr. Sampath Shivangi. Do you believe that the second indictment today has been a blow for Donald Trump, even though he's trying to put up a brave face?
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. First of all, the two indictments are separate. One is business indictment, something he did in before the first election, 2016. There was hush money was given to some woman, but that is nothing to do with the present indictment he may face, or he already has it. But the trial is going to come on next Tuesday in Florida. So there are two different stories. So he has only one indictment as far as the present concern about the papers he kept. But it's not the first time that any president has taken those classified papers to their homes, including the present president Biden has carried those papers to his home. But only difference is he's willing to give them back. So also the previous vice president.
Yes.
So, of course, Hillary Clinton, Obama, all have carried these papers.
But what we understand is that the difference, and even with Mike Pence, is that they all cooperated. But Donald Trump is accused of not cooperating.
Absolutely, I agree. And that's the reason. But he's denying that. But only thing, we cannot decide who is right. Only the court on next Tuesday, he has to say that he's innocent. And of course, then judge will decide where is he going to go.
Okay.
So we'll have to wait until Tuesday to see where we are going.
Right.
I think as far as he says it's witch hunt, it's possible that, you know, when the election comes, Democrats, Republicans are going to fight it out. And this is one of the things I feel has happened.
Okay.
But I think
let me go across to Ajay Jain Bhutaria, because the accusation that this is a witch hunt is against the Biden administration, against President Joe Biden directly. In fact, on what Donald Trump has put out on truthsocial.com right now, he also says, when will Joe Biden be indicted for his many crimes against our nation? Question mark. Would you want to respond to that, considering that he's calling this the greatest witch hunt of all time?
Well, he can call anything he wants, but the fact is that Donald Trump was indicted on April 4 by Manhattan grand jury on 34 counts of falsifying business records. Again, he was indicted on another case on June 7th by a Georgia grand jury on 2 counts of election interference. The charges are related to Trump's attempt to pressure Georgia officials to overturn the election result. And now he is being indicted to investigation by the Department of Justice for handling of the classified documents. And the investigation is reportedly focused on whether Trump took classified documents with him when he left the White House in January 2021. And these are the criminal charges. So this is a very fair process which is going on with the Justice Department, and the Justice Department with all the trials within all these three cases, indictments will proceed, and the judicial system will decide what the outcome of this thing is going to be.
Hmm. John and Blank, considering that Donald Trump is brazening this out, he's saying this is the greatest witch hunt of all time. He's also saying that other former presidents and vice presidents have done the same, and they have not never been indicted for the same charges. Do you believe that this could perhaps at least at the level of him being elected as a, or, you know, elected as a presidential candidate by his own party, it could be, could act in his advantage?
Well, I mean, Trump is facing a charge under the Espionage Act, as well as charges of obstruction of justice, destruction or falsification of record, conspiracy and false statement. And Trump acknowledged on a tape in 2021 meeting that he kept secret information he had not declassified. So all this amounts to the DOJ investigation, and which will bring the outcome to the public. And it will be up to the public to decide, and his core supporters to decide if they still want to support him or they pick up another Republican choice for their nominee.
All right. I had posed that question to Jonah Blank. I'd want him to respond to that as well.
Yes. Thank you for having me. Yes, this is really a case of the former president throwing whatever mad conspiracy theories he wants out there in hopes of confusing people. The fact of the matter is, no former president has ever been accused of doing what he's been accused of doing. And as someone who has had the highest levels of U.S. security clearance for over 2 decades, I can say that that if he has done the things he's alleged to have done, there is no innocent explanation for it. That's just not the way classified information can be handled. The cases of President Biden, of former Vice President Mike Pence, are quite different. They mistakenly took classified documents and gave them back of their own free will. Mr. Trump is accused of having obstructed all efforts and even potentially deliberately linked this information to people who should not have had it. Will that hurt him in the Republican primary? That remains to be seen, because at least two and probably more of his key opponents have already essentially taken his side in this. So it's hard to see how his Republican opponents would defeat him if they are buying into his conspiracy theories.
Hmm. Ambassador Meera Shankar, coming to you now as an outside observer, but somebody who understands and knows the U.S. well, do you see this these allegations that are cropping up against Donald Trump, the indictment, overall impacting what one would call the image of the U.S. as well? After all, he was a former president.
Well, you could see it in two ways. One is that the U.S. institutions and systems are strong enough to actually bring even the most powerful to justice, which possibly couldn't be said about many other countries. and to do it in a legal way through the judicial process. Now, the other question is how this impacts Trump's candidacy. And at, you know, if you look at the US Constitution, it does not put any conditions for anyone to compete in a presidential election beyond being a natural citizen of the US and having lived there for a certain number of years. You know, theoretically, it's quite possible for a candidate with a criminal conviction actually to also stand for the presidential election. And there have been some candidates who did so in the past, though they didn't win. They were really fringe candidates, some of whom contested, you know, while facing imprisonment, actually, for charges of fraud or other charges. But they didn't win. They were really fringe candidates. This is the first former president who has been indicted by grand juries, not just on 34 counts of falsifying his business documents in the case of payoffs to a porn star, but also now in the classified documents case of possessing them illegally, taking them with him, and then obstructing justice by preventing the FBI from accessing those documents till they had a subpoena and they went there and so on. So there are several counts on which he's been indicted by grand juries. Of course, the trial itself, all this means is that the juries found sufficient evidence for a trial to proceed. Now, the question is, will those trials be completed? Will those hearings and trials be completed before the presidential election next year? Theoretically, as I said, even if he is convicted, he could stand. Now, within the Republican Party, you know, there's a group, the Make America Great Again, the MAGA group, which supports Trump fiercely. And Trump himself believes that no matter what he does, this group is so strongly with him that he is the leading candidate for the Republican nomination.
Okay.
So it is possible that this may not prevent him from getting the Republican nomination. But what it will do is that it will have an impact on the presidential election per se, were he to win the nomination, because there are many middle, middle of the road people, citizens of the U.S. Who probably don't want this trauma of, a president who has, you know, been convicted.
Okay.
And,
all right. Okay.
I would say it would be made good.
Okay.
It may not interfere with the Republican nomination of Trump, but it could perhaps, be a downside for a presidential election.
All right. I have the last couple of minutes left. Dr. Shivangi, coming first to you here, because I want to ask you whether the past indictment that you were talking about and the indictment today are very different in nature. One was his related to his own business and what he did in his personal life. The other one relates more to perhaps national security as well. The Espionage Act has also been brought into focus over here. Does the situation now differ even as far as his staunchest supporters are concerned?
Definitely. It is going to hurt his chances, I mean, to be very honest with you. But as Ambassador mentioned, that nobody can stop him running for the upcoming presidential elections. And he has 6 or 8 opponents, but he's a leading candidate.
Okay.
All of them. Okay. So that makes the difference.
Very quickly, Jonah Blank, what explains this kind of support for Donald Trump from within the Republicans?
Well, in my view, as speaking as an anthropologist, as well as a political analyst, I think that he taps into some very deep issues involving race, involving class, that I think do not show America at its best. He's very different from the traditional Republican Party, and a lot of his supporters are not going to be making their decisions based on the law or on, frankly, even the news. They'll be basing it on matters of identity and identity politics, on which he has got a stranglehold on, as your guests have said, at least a third of the Republican base.
All right. I'll have to end this discussion here. Many thanks to all our guests for joining us here on this discussion tonight. With that, we're taking a very quick break. News and updates will continue. Stay with us.